Good morning. I'm Jim Packard, sitting in for Larry Mueller. Glad to have you along with us today on this program as we talk about United States railroads and the possibility of passenger service in the Midwest. Here in the studio is Professor C. Allen Wortley. He directs the Railroad Engineering Program in the Department of Engineering Professional Development at the UW-Madison. Professor Wortley, thank you very much for coming in today.
Thank you, Jim.
Real pleasure to have you with us. And Joe Schachter is a senior policy advocate at the Environmental Law and Policy Center in Chicago, Illinois. And it's great to have Joe Schachter with us. Hello, Joe.
Good morning, Jim.
First off, let's ask Professor Wortley about the Railroad Engineering Program, what it is, what you're hoping that people will take away from it.
The Railroad Engineering Program is a subset of the Engineering Professional Development Department's overall programming. We program to a national market, and we have about 350 courses. And I identified some 7 or 8 years ago that the rail industry really was in need of having some adult continuing engineering education. And so we started up a curriculum of short courses. We now have 7 or 8 of those courses that are active, primarily in engineering, but one in operations. And we offer those courses here on the Madison campus, or for various reasons, off campus from time to time. Like I just came back from the West Coast, where we ran a course there on track design. And I've run some courses down in Chicago and over in Philadelphia, but it's an overall national market that we have.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a huge need in the rail industry for adult continuing education.
Because there are people leaving the industry, and we need to educate the people who are going to follow?
Yes, that's true. And another maxim, at the turn of the century, about 100 years ago, one of the largest programs on the Madison campus was called Railroad Engineering. And they didn't have highways as such, and they didn't have airplanes as such, etc. As far as undergraduate and graduate education, the last major program in the United States was at the University of Illinois, which has always been a big area for railroads in that area. And so my mission is to try to get continuing education going, and we're also trying to help other universities in the United States and Canada about starting up programs again for our undergraduate and our graduate students.
And Joe Schachter, it's been more than a decade since we talked with someone from the Environmental Law and Policy Center. It was March of 1996 about America's Rail Renaissance, as it was called then. The center was and still is backing Amtrak high-speed rail for the Midwest.
Absolutely. And really, the momentum has swung so positively toward the advancement of passenger rail service in the Midwest and the rest of the nation that if anything, we are far more optimistic now than we were 10 years ago for the very simple reason that despite the recent valley in gas prices, that gasoline has gone up so markedly. Plus, there are concerns about global warming. Plus, there are concerns about congestion. Plus, there are concerns about our levels of imported oil. And it's very encouraging, actually, to hear the professor talking about starting up these kinds of curricula again, because we believe that, particularly now with the election of Barack Obama to the presidency, that the future for rail transportation has not been this bright in a long, long time.
Are we really closer than we were a decade ago to a high-speed rail service between Chicago and Minneapolis to include Milwaukee and Madison?
I would say yes. Let me answer the question in a couple of ways. First, the state of Illinois invested considerable funds in upgrading the line between Chicago and St. Louis to take 110 mile an hour, to make 110 mile an hour service a reality. All that remains now to be done is the installation of the cab signals for safe and effective train logistics management along the route, and that service can begin, and we think that will happen in the next couple of years. Very recently, Congressman Oberstar and the mayor of St. Paul came to Chicago to visit with our Mayor Daley on the subject of getting the Minneapolis to Chicago line going next. And with Congressman Oberstar, of course, and his key role at on the Transportation and Infrastructure Committee out in Washington, as well as our mayor, not only very interested in seeing this happen, but in also landing the 2016 Olympics, for which this kind of service is tailor-made.
Mm-hmm.
We believe that Chicago, Milwaukee, and I would add Madison to that equation, Chicago, Milwaukee, Madison, Minneapolis, we think will be one of the next projects to move ahead, particularly when we believe that that under the next administration, infrastructure investment, and that includes not only highways and schools, but rail as well, will be a priority of the incoming team.
Talking with Professor C. Allen Wortley and Joe Schachter, and if you'd like to join the conversation, if you have questions about the United States railroad system, about passenger service, then you can call us at 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us at talk@wpr.org. Are you as optimistic, Professor Wortley, about passenger service here in the Midwest?
Yes, I am, but I don't have the underlying data. But I keep seeing reports from different advocacy groups,
mm-hmm.
and I think there's enough talk going on that enough need is going to be here that it'll eventually come about, maybe sooner than most people think.
One of the big issues facing the rail system is rail sharing between freight and passenger trains. Do you think that this issue can be solved in a safe manner?
Yes.
What does it take? Because you were in California, I saw that there was a rail accident between freight and passenger.
Yes, that has precipitated a lot of discussion, and we were discussing that at my most recent course on train control and signaling, which I ran in Philadelphia, as to just why this happened. And it's not absolutely clear, but I think the person driving the train that was a commuter train fell asleep at the switch, so to speak, and
mm-hmm.
didn't do what they should be doing. And that precipitated some federal legislation immediately to get into positive train control situations. And that's been mandated and passed both houses, and I think as a bill, it's been approved by the president. So certain types of railroads with certain volumes and areas are going to have a positive train control system that would prevent that type of thing. It costs money. And the money has to come from mostly from railroads right now.
Are the railroads in a position to be able to do that?
Yes and no. They'll have to allocate resources as mandated by the law. I have one statement here to give the listeners an upgrade as to what the overall picture is. I'm reading from a brochure for a course in Washington. It's actually a conference for 2 days in December 11 and 12. And this is their opening statement. American railroads, now in their third century, are in the midst of an era of major change and great opportunity with growing freight traffic, increased demand for passenger services, a strong emphasis on environmental issues, increased profitability, and growing opportunity for investment in the public and private arenas. So that's the big picture.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a lot of advocates and people are looking in that direction. And from an engineering point of view, yes, you can make a railroad track safe for different types of uses with different manners, double tracking, triple tracking, control and signaling, scheduling, all those things. Railroads are vitally concerned about increasing their capacity, that is, the amount of people and goods that they can move within a given period of time, and that's a major issue they're working on.
Mm-hmm.
Particularly the Class 1 railroads, if you read their business annual reports, they're quite in tune to the needs of the public and their stockholders.
Let me ask you, Joe Schachter, about Milwaukee to Chicago Hiawatha ridership. I know it was up 26% in the past 12 months as motorists were fleeing high gas prices. What's happened with the Hiawatha now as these gas prices have plummeted?
Well, what we've seen, and we just were meeting with folks at Amtrak yesterday, is that the gas price situation has not been as much of a key to ridership in October, and that's really the month when things started to turn around negatively a little bit, as has been the general just slowdown, severe slowdown in the economy. What Amtrak is reporting to us is that system-wide, business travel ridership in particular has dropped. And I don't think that should be a surprise to much of anyone, given that companies, people are both cutting back at this point in time.
Mm-hmm.
What is far more encouraging, however, is the long-term trend that you were referring to, as well as the trend that we saw here in Illinois when the schedule expanded in our state about 2 years ago. In the first year after Amtrak added additional frequencies each day, and this wasn't even at higher speeds yet, we saw an 80% surge in ridership, and then in the second year, another 20% surge. So the interest in riding the train has never been higher, and I'm just very convinced that when continuing upgrades occur, when the positive train control system that the professor referred to is installed over the next few years, that we will see another big surge in ridership when these trains start going much, much faster and, just as importantly, more reliably than they do today.
All right. Let's take some calls. Again, the number for you to join in is 1-800-642-1234. Let's start with Joe in Wausau. Joe, what's on your mind this morning?
Hi, I just wanted to check and see what the difference, like, why are we having so much problems in the United States with this type of thing when it seems like in Europe and Asia they've already got the high-speed rail. Maybe we're not just hearing about accidents that they're having, but it doesn't seem that they have the problems that we have. And second part was if they do end up putting between Madison, Milwaukee, Minneapolis, or Chicago, is there any plans for a spur line to go up through the Fox Valley, Oshkosh, Appleton, Green Bay?
Joe?
And I'll take my answer off the air.
All right. Joe, you want to start with that?
Sure. I'll actually answer the second question first. The Midwest Regional Rail Initiative that the caller may or may not be aware of is a 9-state regional rail plan developed by 9-state Departments of Transportation over the last several years. And it includes not only an upgraded Chicago, Milwaukee, Madison, Minneapolis route, but indeed a spur up to Green Bay. So the plan definitely includes that. It probably would not be one of the first routes to be done, but it's definitely in the plan. Then as far as the comparison between ourselves and Europe, that's worthy of a whole week's worth of programs right there. But the basic situation has been that the European culture, if you will, and the Asian culture, if you will, have been far more attuned to riding trains than this country has. We have been a country that for really ever since World War II, the end of World War II, has simply fallen in love with the automobile and done everything possible to make the automobile our key mode of transportation.
Mm-hmm.
And there's nothing no rail advocate will ever say, hey, we need to get rid of cars. That's just silly. What we need is balance. And so what we are trying to push with this, for example, this Midwest Regional Rail Plan of 110-mile-an-hour service to points all over the Midwest is indeed an incremental approach that doesn't require all new trackage, whose price tag is not as steep as that of a much higher speed train service. However, we are somewhat modeling the Midwest system on what now seems to be transpiring in California, where about 10 years ago, that state invested significantly in its existing service, sped things up to some extent, but mostly made the system much more reliable. Ridership surged to such an extent with all the additional frequencies and the more reliable service that the state of California, despite the current situation with the economy, voted pretty convincingly by several percentage points to approve a high-speed rail referendum there that authorized the startup of construction for a 200, I believe it is, I may not have that number quite right, but a multi-billion-dollar high-speed line, 220-mile-an-hour service between San Francisco and Los Angeles. So we think that we need to nurse folks along, but that the eventual outcome will be a much more balanced transportation system in our country and in our region, where people don't just have to either drive or fly or not do anything, that the third mode, the all-important third mode of rail, will become increasingly more important as time goes by.
Joe Schachter, Senior Policy Advocate at the Environmental Law and Policy Center in Chicago. Professor C. Ellen Wortley directs the Railroad Engineering Program, the Department of Engineering Professional Development at the UW-Madison. And we'll take more of your calls, and Professor Wortley has a comment coming up in just a moment here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Jim Packard in for Larry Mueller on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Glad to have you along with us. In about 20 minutes, we'll be pairing championship cheeses with championship beers. Brewer Randy Sprecher of Glendale, Wisconsin. Beer maven Lucy Saunders of Milwaukee. Sarah Hill of the Wisconsin Milk Marketing Board will be our guests. And now we continue talking, though, about railroads, passenger service. And I know that you had a comment in response to the last caller, Professor Wortley.
Yeah, I agree with our answer to that question. I'd just like to point out that there are actually four methods of transportation. The airways and highways are crowded and environmentally sensitive and expensive. And rail systems would be the third way. And our river system and canal system is the other way that we move stuff. And they're doing a nominal amount with what they can do on the rivers. So rail is real, and it's going to come sooner or later. And we live in a country that's much wider open than a lot of the European and Asian countries are. And so they're more used to these short trips with trains.
Mm-hmm.
And we're doing intermediate distance trips with airplanes when we could do it better by trains. And the only other method of transportation that I can think of is satellites if you're going to go up and go around the globe and get off somewhere.
So. Makes it a little difficult to find a ticket holder, a ticket counter for that. Let me ask you, just before the show, you talked about some additional money that had been proposed for track design in Wisconsin. Let's talk about that, because that seemed to be one of the hang-ups as far as rail passenger service.
Well, I'm reading from the newsletter from the National Association of Railroad Passengers. It said the first federal intercity passenger train grants are issued. And it mentioned Wisconsin for the installation of welded rail from Roundout to Sturtevant for $5 million. And what they're going to do is improve the ridership quality. By instead of having jointed rails that are tied together every so often, they're going to have a continuous rail system, which gives a smoother ride mm-hmm. and is less damaging to the entire track structure. So that's a small amount of money, but it's a start, and there are something like 15 states that participated in this funding.
Let's go back to the phones and take some more calls, and we'll go to Jordan in Marengo next. Hello, Jordan.
Hey, good morning. I've been kind of following this industry for a long time, and I'd like some feedback on the viability of an issue regarding boosting revenue for Wisconsin Southern. I know that the BNSF across northern Illinois is quite congested. Have there been any discussions with them about routing empty coal and grain trains over the WSOR? Empty trains wouldn't really require that much bridge reinforcement in order to handle that traffic. It could get some extra revenue towards our Wisconsin Southern Railroad. I'd also like to see the track relayed between Green Bay and Hilbert so that the WSOR can meet the Escanaba and Lake Superior directly. That would strengthen the opportunity to relay the rails into Sheboygan Falls, get the traffic off the Union Pacific, and get the line from Sheboygan into Milwaukee into play more as a commuter route. That route there on the UP into Sheboygan is pretty beefy already due to the coal trains, and considering the traffic on I-43 between Sheboygan and Milwaukee, I bet you it's a short run. There's a lot of ridership there. And in spite of the economic downturn, I am not selling any of my rail stocks, and I would appreciate any feedback if any of these ideas have been discussed at the state level. Thanks a lot.
Professor Wortley, are you able to answer any of his questions?
No, except the investment is a good idea. Some of the Class 1s and smaller railroads have done very well recently, and I don't know what Wisconsin and Southern Railroad's plans are for that corridor.
Mm-hmm. And Joe Schachter, I doubt that you have an answer for him.
Unfortunately, I do not, but I would concur with the professor's view on those investment strategies.
One of the callers has a son who's interested in a rail career. Can you tell him, Professor Wortley, where he can get information about schools and about education in a rail career?
Well, the Internet would be one source, but there aren't very many schools that have any courses. The University of Illinois has 4 courses at the senior graduate level on campus, and then there are different schools around the country, 4 or 5 schools that have a course or 2. The closest one here is Michigan Tech. They've started up a new program there, and they have a minor, if you might call it that, in railroad engineering, and they have a student club and all that stuff. If depending on his age, there is a very good publication from the Boy Scouts of America, Merit Badge. It's about a 30-page little booklet that you have to study and do certain things, and then you get a star on your merit badge for that. And depending on his age, that would be a very good source of information as to what the whole career of railroading is all about. And there are other sources like that, too. But as far as what school to sign up for, I can't tell you yet. Our campus is considering that in civil engineering, a course or 2, something like that.
All right. Professor C. Allen Wortley at the UW-Madison. Joe Schachter is a senior policy advocate at the Environmental Law and Policy Center in Chicago. And you can find lots of information at elpc.org. Doug in Mount Horeb has a question. Hi, Doug.
Hi. I was just wondering if you see any conflict or issues coming down the road between bike trails and rail lines. My dad and I, when I was younger, used to ride Hiawatha in Milwaukee, and I'm a big railroad fan, been on the Empire Builder, and take the train to Florida and Chicago and other places. And I'm also a member of the Wisconsin Bike Federation and contribute to the Rails to Trails program, which undoes the rails. And now I find myself riding bike on these great trails that used to be great rail lines. And I wonder what's going to happen down the road.
Professor Wortley, you have any thoughts on that?
I don't know. I thought Rails to Trails program, once that right-of-way is given up, it could be only on a lease basis. I don't know the answer to that.
Okay. And Joe?
The way I think I might answer that is that for plans like the Midwest Regional Rail Initiative that I was describing earlier, the good news is that that entire plan is based on the use of existing rights of way. So there's no concern about having some of these routes of the past turned into bike paths to date, because the routes that are envisioned involve rights of way that still exist. I would say that it's, I think, going to be a much slower process for having some of these older rail lines designated as new trails in the environment that we're now in, simply because rail transportation is once again picking up, and folks may not want to lose that infrastructure, because once it's gone, it's very expensive to put it back.
Doug, thanks for the call. We appreciate hearing from you. Greg in Watertown. Hi, Greg.
Good morning. I have a similar comment to the last one, but before I go there, I'd just like to say that if we were to do the high-speed rail between Chicago and Minneapolis, that I think it would garner a lot of support by communities such as Jefferson County. I'm a board supervisor there, and we would see this type of action as a tremendous boon for not only the economy, but our local environment. Get some of the cars off of the road, clean up our air, give us a different option besides the automobile for transportation. And that leads me then to my second question/comment. The fifth mode of transportation is human-powered transportation. And I think we're past the time that we have single-use right-of-ways. I really don't see any reason why we can't. Well, I guess I see a few reasons, but I think they could be overcome, that we use these corridors, these right-of-way corridors, for multi-use transportation. How much room does a bicycle lane off to the side of a rail corridor take? Right-of-ways are really difficult to establish through an area, and it's much, much easier to garner another 20 feet off to the side to put a bicycle trail, a human-powered pedestrian bicycle trail along a corridor, than it would be to create a whole new corridor. and or to stick it next to a road, mm-hmm. which seems to have much, much, much more traffic per hour than a train rail does. And here in Jefferson County, we're trying to link the Glacial River Trail, which is an old rail corridor, to the Wild Goose Trail up in Clyman, which is a rail corridor. And there are a few sections there that the only possible solution would be either put them out on the roads, let them fend for themselves with the traffic, or open up a small corridor right next to the rail corridor in that same right-of-way. And I'd like to understand why that is such an impossible thing to do, to work with the rail companies to make this happen.
Professor Wortley, is this something that is addressed during one of your courses that you administer?
No, it isn't. And I apologize. I forgot about the bikers. I guess in the back of my mind that was surface transportation on wheels like automobiles. And now we have hikers also and runners to contend with. You know, on the highway system we have, and they do it in Europe and in Asia, they have bicycle lanes parallel to highway lanes all the time. I'm not aware of any railroad that has bicycles on that right-of-way. There may be federal legislation that would have to be somehow set up to protect the bicyclists.
Mm-hmm.
And you're not allowed, you're a trespasser if you're walking a railroad right-of-way, and there's a fine for it, and they're policing that more and more. It would have to get some real change of thinking on the part of both parties, the bikers and the railroads, and some sort of safety separation. I'm not sure what it would be.
And Joe Schachter, is this something that you think about?
Well, we certainly do think about making it easier for bicyclists and pedestrians to move about. I would share the same safety concerns that Professor Wortley brought up, that there is, for example, here on in the Chicago area, the Metra North line runs right along in the northern suburbs of Chicago, a well-used bicycle path, but there is a very clear fenced arrangement where the bikes are X feet away from the train. So I guess there would be a question of width, there'd be a question of safety that would all have to be worked out, but certainly we endorse the concept of human-powered transportation as well.
Joe Schachter is a senior policy advocate at the Environmental Law and Policy Center in Chicago, which advocates for high-speed rail in the Midwest. And one of our callers wondered whether or not there would be multiple stops in the Madison area if such a line were to start up.
The concept that we have heard is that because Madison does not have an existing Amtrak does not even pass through Madison at this point. The closest point, I believe, is Columbus.
Correct.
The renovations first would be going from Milwaukee to Watertown, and that then there would really be a selection process as to whether or not it would be the Madison Airport that gets a stop, or whether it would be downtown Madison, or both. And that, I don't believe, has been worked out yet. But mm-hmm. what is encouraging is that Governor Doyle has set aside, I believe it's $80 million for construction for Milwaukee-Madison service, and that would then be the state's portion of a presumed 80%, 20% split with the federal government. And with the federal government having recently enacted the Rail Safety Improvement Act that was referred to earlier, that act includes for the very first time a federal pool of funds that can be used for by states to get some of these big infrastructure projects going. So hopefully, particularly as we transition to the new administration, Wisconsin would be right at the top of the list there in terms of getting its share of that money to do Milwaukee-Madison. And then the final stop or stops in the state capital could be chosen.
1-800-642-1234 is the number for you to join in the program today as we talk about the United States railroad system and passenger service. Royce in Madison is next. Hi, Royce. What's on your mind today?
Good morning. I have not heard, relative to positive train control, if that's going to allow passenger trains to go faster than the current top speed of 79 miles an hour, unless you're in the Northeast Corridor, and it would certainly be nice to at least catch up with the Canadians and run it 90, and even, you know, we're talking about 110 on the longer term.
Mm-hmm. Professor Wardley?
High speed is not clearly defined, in my understanding. If it's 99 miles per hour and over, some people call it high speed. But then there's higher speeds, much higher than that. And I can't answer technically the question about the new positive train control, but I'd like to think that it could be a system that could be worked up to handle all the speeds of all the trains that are on the tracks.
Just a matter of the wiring that goes into it, huh?
Well, the algorithms that are used and the methods of checking it, where every vehicle, where every train is on the track, mm-hmm. between the two distances that they're doing, they ought to be able to handle a small speed or a high speed. But I don't know for sure how that system is going to work.
All right, Royce, thank you very much for the call. Mike and Racine, let's give you a chance. Go ahead.
Hi, I wanted to take the conversation back and wonder if how much is being looked at how some of the rail business was done in the past. I know when I talked to my father and uncles who were raised and had farms in northern Wisconsin, you know, in the Lady Smith, Sawyer County, you know, the areas are there, is that they used to be able to have ready, reliable freight service where they could take orders on demand. They could get an order by telegraph in the afternoon, and they could get produce, animals, whatever, shipped directly to market in Chicago overnight, so that at the small store or the butcher shop in the morning, literally in less than 12 hours, they could have product shipped. And I think that would be a challenge for most of our stuff today. But I think what supported that is that they had mixed commerce rail. But right now, freight rail seems to dominate the commodity market, the coal, building materials, chemicals, things of that nature. And, you know, you're talking about getting into high-speed rail for passengers. But I think what I would like to see is, where's the investigation at using some of the modern technologies around containerized shipping and the IT capabilities we have to plan and route shipping? Is why can't it work the way it used to, using pen and ink back in the day, where you get mixed commerce? So a little bit of passenger, a little bit of freight, some mail, some parcel service. That for those types of services, that they can be containerized and quickly unloaded and offloaded at a particular railhead. You might have a few passenger cars to be able to do some passengers. I think if you had regular shipments, you could expand this far beyond just this high-speed passenger mart, which is relatively limited stops, limited number of places to go. Basically, any place there's a freight line, you could conceivably run a passenger service along with light freight and other types of services. I think a big part of that is if we could convince the parcel services, FedEx, UPS, U.S. Mail, to do some of their lower-end, lower-class freight using containerized shipping, you could probably expand this market very, very quickly and economically.
Professor Wardley.
I don't know how that would come about in the near future. We have airplanes and trucks that are handling the short hauls mostly. We have independent short-line railroads that go from points like the caller is talking about, mm-hmm. to a rail connection of some sort. And those smaller railroads would be interested if the market is there and if they could be competitive with what's being done by trucking now. We have on the Madison campus a federal program called the National Center for Freight and Infrastructure Research and Education. Its acronym is CFIRE. And they're looking into transportation for trucking and for rail in the general area that you're talking about. So I would have you look at their website and see if there's anything on there. That's all I know about that subject.
Okay. Mike, thank you very much for the call. We appreciate hearing from you. Another Mike in Oshkosh has a question. Hi, Mike.
Yes, a couple of questions and comments. I'm a great fan of the European rail system, and I wonder if you're familiar with the recent run that they, well, it isn't that recent anymore, but between Strasbourg and Paris, they approached 300 miles an hour. In fact, I think they were over 300. and they're beginning to compete with airport service for rapid transportation between cities. Now, they don't routinely run at that 300. They routinely run at 180-something.
Mm-hmm.
But I would be worried about bicyclists riding along that stretch of track, that they might actually get sucked in by the train. And I'm wondering about rolling stock.
Well, I think there's a fence between them, so there would have to be sucked through the fence.
Okay.
I have a comment on being sucked by a fast train. There's been research on that. People brought it up in some of my short courses. And if you're standing right on a platform and a high-speed train goes by, you're not sucked towards the train. That's what some researchers have found. High-speed trains, they're all competing with one another. It's just like the high-rise buildings all over the world. They're all trying to be a little bit better than the last one. And the speed is going to be a function of what the needs are and the capacity of the railroad and what they want to invest in. The real high-speed rail is very expensive.
And Joe Schachter, you must have some familiarity with that kind of high-speed rail in Europe.
Oh, absolutely. And this actually gets back to a question from a couple of callers ago regarding the positive train control system and the maximum speeds. Legally, PTC, or positive train control, must be in place for trains to go higher than 79 miles an hour, and what it does do is get the authorized maximum speed up to 110. So, for example, in the Midwest Regional Rail Initiative Plan, the Chicago-St. Louis corridor, which, as I mentioned earlier, just needs its positive train control signals installed, that will be allowed to go 110. There's about a 20-mile corridor in southwest Michigan that also will have positive train control, and already has it, actually, and is now in final testing to also go to 110. So that's what would happen in Wisconsin, too. From Chicago, Milwaukee, Madison, Minneapolis would be 110. And what that does is allow the use of existing right-of-way. When you go above 110, what the most recent caller was referring to, very often those are dedicated passenger tracks. And so now you're talking, as the professor just said, of a very expensive project in which you are adding brand new infrastructure. And that ratchets up the price tag to the level now that California is approving. But I think that here in the Midwest, we will probably take the incremental approach that California did before we're willing to make that kind of big leap.
Joe, thank you very much for being with us. Again, people can keep up with the work that the Environmental Law and Policy Center is doing in this field at elpc.org. Pleasure to have you with us today.
Thank you, Jim, very much. Pleasure to be with you.
And Professor C. Allen Wortley, what can you recommend to people who are interested in some of the courses that you have mentioned or referenced during our program today?
They can look at our website, which is EPD, Engineering Professional Development, .engr, for engineering, .wisc, .edu.
All right, EPD, .engr, .wisc, .edu.
Correct.
And again, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thanks for inviting
us. Very
us.
Interesting. Professor C. Allen Wortley, directing the Railroad Engineering Program in the Department of Engineering Professional Development at the UW-Madison. I'm Jim Packard, and coming up, we'll pair some championship cheeses with championship beers here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.